Afternoon. I don't think I need to introduce myself. I was asked to say a little bit what a Dharma talk is. Well, Thich Nhat Hanh says one should listen to a Dharma talk as if, this part I inferred, as if you're like a flower and you're just receiving the rain or the sun or the moonlight. Because mostly we listen and we say, I like it, I don't like it, it's good, it's bad. And then we go off on our own story instead of listening deeply. So that's one. In Zen, there are different kinds of Dharma talks. And the formal one is called Taisho. And it means an expression of the shout. Sometimes that's why you read Zen things and sometimes they scream. Another way to put that is that I'm trying to convey the Dharma in some ways through my words. And also in Zen we say when you open your mouth, you've made a mistake. So I apologize beforehand. And so maybe to bring those two together, receive what is useful to you and let go of what isn't. So what are you doing here? What have you been doing with your day today? For last night, and this morning's instructions, you are encouraged to follow the schedule, follow your breath, noting walking movements, social distance, all sorts of information and instructions. How's it going? How's your practice going? Bruni and I, of course, and this is all clear with Bruni, what I'm going to be saying. Of course, we, you know, she invited me to do this months ago, if not last year. And we talked about the theme of the retreat and, you know, certain kind of practices. And in preparing for this talk, I realized actually what we're doing here is practicing, is to practice knowing that you are not in control. We're practicing to know that we're not in control. And yet that doesn't keep us from trying. Would that be true? Maybe some things you've tried, because I've been a yogi here, and of course at many places, but deciding, you know, I have some control where I can sit. I used to like to come early, make sure, because, you know, being a person of color, being female, being queer, I have safety issues. I don't like to be too close to the front. I don't like to be where people are walking a lot, right? And so I like to make sure I have some control over that by picking a seat. And I remember one year I came kind of late here, so I had limited choices. So I picked a place, you know. And actually before that, I should say that I've heard that there are two things when you're meditating that will, when you have really practiced with it and really sat through it in a very full way, it really shifts your practice. And one is when you sit through pain. Right? And of course, it's about managing pain, not being too much and all that. And this is what we do when we come to practice or to a retreat, is a lot of it has to do with effort. And it indeed is true for the first day. You've heard me say that. So in a lot of ways, we're practicing with our effort. And so there's a lot around pain for many of us. So when you have an experience where you actually see the rise and fall of pain as just pain, as a shift in your practice, your relationship to it change. And that's certainly been my experience. And the other is an itch. Right? I heard that's like the thing for a lot of people. And I was like, I don't understand that one. You know, pain I understand, but not an itch. Well, that day when I picked that spot, which, you know, right under the vent, it's over there. Nobody's sitting there right now, I don't think. Or maybe you might be close. The vent, the air, you know, circulation is just coming down, and there's always this air right over my face. And so it's just, you know, itch, ticklish kind of itchy, right? And so that, for a few days, that was my suffering, right? And I was like, ah, I get it now, how that could be. So there's a lot of ways. I know as a vegan, I like to manage food. I have some, you know, food deprivation issues. Or worries, like at this point, about being vegan, not in food in general, about being vegan. So managing it. In fact, you know, I came and I was vegan, and I heard that, oh, it's going to be a vegan retreat, all the food. And I was like, oh, that's fantastic. Right? And then, oh, and then there'll be some eggs and some cheese. And then I was like, what? That's not all vegan then, right? Now, this is not about judging whether it should shouldn't be, but it's just talking about how we relate to things, right? Just hearing things, we have an idea, and then we figure out how we manage it. I will say, after having heard that, even though I heard the cook say, everything's labeled, all the main foods vegan, now I still look at all the labels. See, so there's a response that comes from what we hear. And certainly we, as in IRC, the managers or service leaders, I think that's what they call, and the teachers, we have tried to manage the retreat, haven't we? Right? We have COVID protocols. We'll test you guys again tomorrow. Then, you know, one point I said, oh, and then we might take off our masks. And then Bruni's like, no. And because her father has, has cancer, she's very concerned. So this is why we keep our masks on, though she said I could have taken my mask off when I give the talk. And she has chosen not to, and I'm holding that as a way to support her. Right? And we validate it, that we know what we're doing. We got this under control, right? This is a lineage, this ancestors, this 2,600 years almost of practice. And I'm a reverend. I have a lot of control and practice, wouldn't you say? Or that's the image I would like to put out. So for perhaps more correctly, practice is about practicing to know that we think or believe that we're in control. And that's a huge part of how we suffer. And this morning I had a suffering. Morning instruction happened, and it didn't go the way I thought it would. And, you know, I talked with Rini. I had a couple of times I was like, should I say something to her or not? Or them, excuse me, them or not. And, their eyes were closed, so I decided not to bother them. And then, we talked about, okay, is this what we were going to do or not? And it wasn't any big thing, except it was just really trying to clarify, right? So really, it's a trying to understand what went wrong. Didn't we agree this is how we're going to teach, what we're going to talk about? And there were a moment, again, it was mild, because, by the way, I also want to say that Bruni and I met. I was just saying, where do we meet? Because I don't remember how we met, except for about 3 years ago. At the last minute, I cover for John, who usually leads this retreat, used to lead this retreat with Bruni. And the last minute I covered because he was sick, and we really got along. Like, I think she's, you know, we're this from the same mother separated at birth in a past life. Like that, like, I love Bruni. And I just like, always were like, I'm always like, hi sis, love, 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 in all the emails. And so sometimes with that you think, oh, we have simpatico. We're Dharma teacher, we're gonna communicate well, everything's gonna be okay, right? And no, doesn't always happen that way. So I will say in the talk, even though really I wasn't, you know, it was not one of those really reactive thing, but there were a moment where I was like, oh, Bruni's like this. And then there were moments where I thought to myself, oh, maybe I'm too controlling, too whatever. So I went back to the teacher's quarter, and we decide, okay, we think we know what we're doing now, and I should go my route. Because, you know, my talk has already been formulated for this afternoon, right? And worked to a certain degree. So I go back to the teacher's quarter, the treehouse. And I was like, oh, now I really have to do this right. Really. I have to make it make sense, show her how it can work, this idea, because it was my idea to try to put some points together. I got to the treehouse. It was cold. And I thought, oh, I need something warm. Maybe I'll make a cup of tea. And then I was like, no, I don't have time. I have to get this right. So I go to my room, which is at the back. It's dark. I turn on the light because I said, I just have to focus. I just have to make this right. Looking at the work in progress, looking up the Pali Canon quote to go with it, right? Because I have to make this work. And all of a sudden my eyes were just so, so tired. So tired I was. I couldn't keep my eyes closed. So I said, okay, I have time. I'll just take a 20-minute nap. That will help a lot. So I go and I lay down in the bed. And by the way, when I lived at Tassajara, it's hot as heck in the summer. You work a lot. So I trained myself to take short naps. Right? And a lot of that has to do with just totally relaxing. Lying down on my back. I have a very specific way of doing it, but it works for me, right? So I was in that position, looking up, starting to relax, and then I thought, ah, practicing is to practice knowing that you're not in control. That's the point of my talk, really. So here's from Charlotte Jokel Beck, who was a Zen teacher, called Ordinary Wonders. And this is part of a chapter called No Effort, Tremendous Effort, on a section called Ease and Effort. I find that practicing well takes effort. At the same time, to experience life as it is without any trying, thinking, or doing is to experience effortlessness. How are these things both true? Life is often a struggle. We have things we want to happen and stuff we think and believe should happen that doesn't. We are tired of the struggle, and yet to give up the core belief that is keeping us in the struggle takes conscious attention. To the extent that I've been living an incomplete life, it requires effort to experience more of reality. Our habit is to narrow down what we think of as reality to suit what we think of as, quote, our lives, end quote. So practicing is to practice knowing that we believe we're in control, and that's a huge part of why we suffer. Or it could be practicing is to practice knowing that we think we're in control, and how we don't have to suffer. Notice I didn't say practice is to realize at some point you will have control. That's a big, right? I didn't say that. What we get to do is to decide or practice that we have more choice in our response when things are happening in a way that we don't not think is the way we want it to be or seems out of control. So we are going to talk about what supports or can give us pointers and instruction on how not to suffer. And darn it, I'm going to make my point, right? Which is what we'd agree to talk about, Bernie, which are two sets of teachings. So one, I do have an insight start to my meditative practice. I was born a Buddhist, but not meditation practice. So when I did first start, it was in the Spirit Rock tradition of insight. Then I went to the Tassajara just to work, to do 1 3-month, not to become a Zen person. And then I stayed 3.5 years and became a priest, right? Bruni has a Zen background too. Now she's mostly Vipassana. Now I mix Vipassana and Zen. So, you know, we're very clear, this is an insight mindfulness-based meditation retreat on the four foundation of mindfulness. So that's one that we're going to talk about. And then I've submerged, not just thinking, in the Four Noble Truths. And lately I've been thinking that the four Brahma-Viharas are actually great practice qualities to go with each of the Four Noble Truths. So for instance, if you know your Four Noble Truths, I'll give you the classic simple version. First, in life there is suffering. So metta, or unconditional friendliness or goodwill, is a useful response, I think, when we're suffering. How can I know well-being? How can I be happy? How can I know safety? How can I have peace and ease? I think those are really helpful qualities of aspiration, and there's a whole practice of extending it. And really the practice of the Brahma-Viharas, that metta is one, is that it's really about strengthening our sense that they're true and possible, right? So that the way I explain it is kind of like I'll name the other ones first, then I'll tell you my analogy, right? So metta is first, usually, then karuna, or compassion, which in Buddhism is very specific, the wish and desire and ability at some point to alleviate suffering for oneself or others. So I think that's a really useful quality to think about, or a group of qualities that go with it, to go with the second noble truth. And what are the roots to the arising of dukkha or suffering? By the way, suffering is the standard for dukkha. I myself prefer dis-ease, or dissatisfaction, discontent. And to be honest, these days I'm thinking overwhelm is a good word for dukkha. Then third is the end of suffering as possible. And so mudita, which I would say as inclusive joy, is a really great group of qualities around to go with that. Because really the end of suffering should be celebrated. It's a joyful moment. And then the Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth, which is the ways to develop, to achieve happiness or not suffering. And they are, of course, skillful view, which is essentially the four noble truths and karma. Skillful thinking, or really it's motivation, because it's always purposive, our thinking. That's called the wisdom third. The second grouping of three is skillful speech, skillful actions, skillful livelihood or living, I like to say. And then the third is what's called the samadhi, or the meditative. By the way, the second is called the ethical conduct, or I like to say the compassionate connection third. So the last is the meditative qualities, which is skillful effort, skillful mindfulness, and skillful concentration. So why they're classically listed that way, the whole idea is actually the meditative qualities are the bridge. So the first set is called the wisdom. Well, you can think of it as this is my view of the world as the Four Noble Truths and karma, and that motivation is really important. So that's my wisdom or my sense of values or how the world is. And then the ethical conduct is the interactive part, right? How I speak, how I act, how I interact in living. So your meditation helps you to, when you sit down to meditate or the meditative qualities, you're evaluating, oh, am I living in accordance with my values? Or are my values in accordance with how I live? So for that, upekkha or equanimity, which classically in the Brahmavihara is very much equanimity that's based on understanding karma, causes and conditions. So that's how I was thinking these, exploring these as we go through the retreat, one per day, obviously. So today is metta, obviously. So to go to the four foundation of mindfulness, right? It actually tells us all these things, as I see it. There are many things that the Satipatthana Sutta will lay out, and here's my case for it. So this is from the Nisaro Bhikkhu. All right, Satipatthana, the establishing of mindfulness, is a meditative technique for training the mind to keep mindfulness firmly established in a particular frame of reference in all its activities. The term sati, which is mindfulness, is related to the verb sarati, to remember or to keep in mind. It is sometimes translated as non-reactive awareness, free from agendas, simply present with whatever arises, but the formula for Satipatthana does not support that translation. Non-reactive awareness is actually an aspect of equanimity, one of the mental qualities fostered in the course of Satipatthana. Okay, key two sentences here. The activity of Satipatthana, however, definitely has a motivating agenda, the desire for awakening, which is classed not as a cause of suffering, but as part of the path to its ending. The role of mindfulness is to keep the mind properly focused in the frames of reference that will give it guidance in what present event to develop and which ones to abandon so as to keep it on the path. All right, I'll lay that out a little bit. So let's take the last line with its three parts. The role of mindfulness is to keep the mind properly focused. Right. So in essence, are the instructions of the 4 days of the retreat is this. The mind properly focused on in frames of reference that will give it guidance in what present events. So every day we're giving you instruction on what events that are present and how to pay attention to them. Today it was on breath and on walking. The first foundation of mindfulness is awareness of the body in the body. So breath and posture or body are two of the main ones. So those are the frame of reference to be present. Now, so you do that to develop frame of reference that will give it guidance in what present events, what's going on, to develop and which ones to abandon so as to keep it on the path. The path is the Eightfold Path, which leads to enlightenment in the Theravada tradition, right? So in essence, we're being clear about the frame of references so that we know how to develop them and or which to abandon. In the succeeding days, the other frame of reference are what are called feeling tones, which Bernie would talk about. No, I'm going to do more body tomorrow, then Bernie would talk about feeling tones, and then we'll do mind states and grouping of mind states on the last day. Okay. Now, to keep us on the path, and I did say it's the Eightfold Path and liberation, but it actually takes us back to that the first of the two sentences that I said is really important. The activity of Satipatthana, however, definitely has a motivating agenda, the desire for awakening, which is classed not as a cause of suffering, but as part of the path to its ending. So the four foundation of mindfulness, or the four frame of reference, leads us into understanding the four noble truths. And again, I think the qualities of the Brahma Vihara support understanding of the four noble truths. So today we're talking about the first noble truth, which is in life there is suffering. And really the issue is about what part of suffering is how things are, and what part of suffering is it that we can do something about. Sometimes it's framed as there is suffering, and then there's I don't know if extra suffering is it. There are actually three kinds of suffering in Buddhism. It's called dukkha-dukkha, which is the suffering of the body, of getting old, of when you hit your toe. Oh my goodness, talking about, you think I would be more mindful. I'm in the room where the bed is big, and it has one blanket on it, and it covers the whole side, but I thought, oh, I'm going to be too cold. So I go to put on another blanket, but it covers up the ends, you know? So I bumped my knee, right, on one side. Then I go to the other side and I bump my other knee. So now I have two bumps on both sides of the knee, right? Now, so that's dukkha-dukkha when I bump it. Then there's the dukkha of me going, how stupid that I was not mindful, right? Or why don't they, show this so that everyone can see it, right? So that's the extra suffering, because does it really help to judge myself or to beat myself up? No, right? So that's the dukkha that we can think of as, where in our experience of life is there something that we can alleviate? And today, in particular, obviously I'm talking about our ideas of how things are, right? Now the practice, each of the Four Noble Truths has a practice instruction. And for the first noble truth, it's to investigate. So I have what I'm calling when you investigate, you have the five W's and the one H. Any journalist majors in here? Or any, you probably learned this in middle school, right? Who, what, where, when, why, and how. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So yeah, who, what, where, when, why, and how, right? Who, pretty obvious, you. Especially today, you just want to stay right here with yourself. What and where are the four foundations of mindfulness? Every day we give you a place, a where, and a what to pay attention to. When is always right now, during your retreat. It's hard because I know we really want to go look at the schedule over and over again. We think lunch will change the time and it's totally true, right? So nothing has changed, and yet we just keep on wanting to control the when. That's a way of controlling the when. Like somehow we think the more I know, the more I'm going to have some sense of what it is, when really a lot of our practice is just to relax into the present moment. So the when is right here and right now. And the why is because it's freedom and liberation. And the irony is that we get closer and closer to suffering so that we can see how we can be free from suffering. I love a quote from Gill, I can't remember where he says it, you know, where he says, in our society in the United States, for the most part, we think freedom is to. I should have the freedom to buy whatever I want, do whatever I want. But really, in Buddhism, our freedom is from. Freedom from the suffering that we can let go of. So the how, again, goes back to the lines from the Satipatthana. To develop, right? To develop and which ones to abandon. So which one do you develop and which one do you abandon? Again, every day we give you a point what to develop. I know it's going to be hard because you're going to want to develop other things, but try to stay with the instruction, right? And to just take it step by step. And then in terms of abandoning, for today, is to abandon the sense of control. I think it's actually part of the effort of the first 2 days of a retreat. How much can I control things? Right, and maybe it doesn't come out as control. It comes out as stress. It comes out as anxiety. Comes out as I like or I don't like. I want more. What am I missing? Loneliness. A lot of passions that come up. We'll talk more about that another day. And I want to say that what we can do is to actually, the positivity of that is actually to develop, to really work on this effort. Where can we adjust our efforts? And this is what I want to talk about with the Brahmaviharas in each of these, in today's metta. So there's a story, probably many of you have heard it, about Sonia. Right? Sonia. The end with the dot on the bottom, I think, is a hard end. Sona plays the lute and was actually, he was in a retreat and doing walking meditation. And he was so efforting so hard that his feet started to bleed, right? Because he, as you may remember, in the Buddha's day, they went barefoot, right? When they're mendicants and they went barefoot, right? So his feet started to bleed. So then he thought to himself, oh, my family is pretty well off. I don't have to do this. Maybe I should just go back to my family and live a good life. I don't have to be doing this. And so the Buddha, in his infinite sense of thing, heard it. And so from wherever he was, he appeared in front of Sona and said, now, you used to play the lute, didn't you? And so when you tune the lute too hard, did you get a good sound? I said, oh no, Lord, I didn't. When you tune it too little, did you get a good sound? Oh, no, Lord, no, that doesn't happen. So it's really about how do you tune your effort in the first 2 days. I do think that, and my students would know, that I do say that it does take skillful effort. So don't forget that all the Eightfold Path have skillful in front of them, right? And it's really important with mindfulness, by the way, because in popular mindfulness, people just think mindfulness is it. But skillful is the key. And skillful is very much specifically whether it's towards the cause of non-harming or in accordance with the Four Noble Truths, right? In terms of the Eightfold Path. So, in terms of skillful effort, when is it too little or too much? And I think all that, of course, is individual, and I think as oppressed people, that actually remembering ease is really important. And so this is why I think the Brahma Viharas, who are the four qualities are taught by the Buddha as easeful mental qualities. And they're actually just along with like dana. Dana is at the beginning of many of the lists of practices that the Buddha taught. So in the Brahma Vihara, they're very much taught as easeful practices before you go and do more intensive mind training. Right? So how can we use metta wisely as a way to adjust our effort, especially as oppressed people? We're often told that we're not good enough. We need to do more. You know, you got to do 110, some of us 125% to prove that we're good enough. So, metta, the class's phrases are, and today we just stick with I. May I be filled with loving kindness is one. Goodwill or unconditional friendliness, I prefer. May I be connected with a sense of well-being. Let me connect with a sense of safety whenever I need it. Let peace and ease guide me. And let me know true happiness. Now, in this tradition, begin with the breath. And, you know, we want to watch what is the quality of attention we bring to our breath. I know that often in the beginning, you know, I find myself wandering off, and then I come back to the breath, but I don't come back gently. I force myself to come back. Right? And that doesn't mean, you know, intentionally taking a deep breath is a forcing, unless the quality of it is like, damn it, I have to come back. Or that was wrong, I need to do something right. So what is the quality that you're coming back to your breath? What is the quality as you're lifting your leg or placing your foot? What is the quality of the exhale? What is the quality? Is there kindness that you can bring to it? Is there a sense of, imagine, let's try it. Take an inhale and think of it as, sense it as that it's for your well-being. Did anyone think of that today? Honestly, until I thought of it this moment for you guys to do, I have not thought of my breath inhale today as a sense of well-being. So doesn't it feel differently? Say, well-being. I mean, your breath is your life. What about safety and protection? Am I being safe with myself when I force myself to come back or to, you know, do X, Y, or Z that I think needs to happen? Are you happy on the exhale? Is there friendliness to your experience today? I was going to call this talk, Metta is a Choice. And actually, I've changed it to Choose Metta. And I'll tell you why. To me, Metta is a choice, gives you that sense, I have a choice to do it. So it is something you're free to choose to do. You could choose kindness instead of harshness in your thoughts, in your responses, in your movements, in your breath. You could choose that this inhale is for my well-being. I could choose that maybe I look up and I make judgment. So I'm going to choose, safety is when I can look down and just come back. Safety for myself, for the other person. Or is it choosing peace and ease instead of following a train of thought that you know or that you feel brings you more agitation? So it's an adjustment. You're using metta as an adjustment that when is it that you're overly tuning your effort the next 24 hours? Can you do it with peace and with ease? Approaching your food. Is there peace and ease in eating? Or is it some thing to get done to get onto the next thing, or something to do to get away from something? Right? So whatever that's coming up, it also is, can you meet what's coming up with kindness? Or that, where is it in here? If you have an obsessive thought, sometimes the best way to work with it is actually just to listen to it, like as a friend would, not the content, right? Sometimes, you know, maybe I'm the only one that does this, but if I have a friend who, you know, most of us have some frame of story that we go over and over, different people change, but the story stays the same, right? And that we all have it, so. But sometimes, you know, you listen to a friend, you yourself are going, oh yeah, I've heard this version, but different characters before. And so you're not really listening to the content, but you're listening to the affect, or you're listening to what you think would be supportive. So you're strengthening your witness. By the way, that's the most useful tool, if there's a tool at all, to our mindfulness, is that you're strengthening your witness factor to the degree of eventually it'll give you freedom, of course. So you can, when there's an obsessive story, is there a way to relate to it in a way that holds it in kindness, right? To attend to it as opposed to push it away or to reject it. Choose happiness. Did anyone think about happiness today? Try it on. Touch metta, receive metta, convey metta. Actually, that reminds me of a story. One retreat I was here, and actually was the theme was on the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I was having a really hard time, you know. And every time Gil spoke, I was just like, wah! Right? I just, wah! Right? And Buddha, I don't remember the specific, blah. Dharma, blah, right? And then it was Sangha, right? And I was already feeling very emotional. And so I went downstairs, you know, to go use that bathroom downstairs. Oh, I was going to go do walking, but then I was already down there when I realized I had to, you know, use the bathroom. But obviously I'm a person of color, and we're actually very happy that there really great inclusivity in this retreat. And for the most part, in most retreat I've been in, there have been predominantly white people. So I was going to the bathroom, and this white woman was doing walking meditation on that carpet, right? Just notice it. And then I came out, right? Put on my shoes, go out, and went right and started walking down the path, and there's a little bench there. And all of a sudden, it just hit me. Sangha is everybody, including that white woman doing walking meditation on the carpet. It blew my mind, like so much that I like bend over and bawled, right? And I was just shaking with crying, like this realization. And like, it's not like I, you know, I'm a teacher, right? All beings. I've done metta meditation for all beings, on and on and on. But it really stuck in the way that was just like, oh, without exception. So it was so much that, and then, you know, then I, of course, like, oh, I don't want to be on the path because someone might come. So I went and sat on one of those sides. There was a stump or something. And I'm still bawling. And then, and I was bawling so much, you know, that my eyes were all, you know, and I was just, blah, right? And also because I was just so pulled into myself, so that the surrounding was present, but I was very, I wasn't looking for people or anything. I was with my experience completely in this realization of all beings, really. And then to this day, I have no idea who it is, but someone doing walking meditation in a yellow jacket. I remember that. I have no idea if they noticed me or anything, but I swear to you, I felt this huge wave. Maybe it's a yellow jacket. I have no idea. This huge wave of metta coming at me. Right? And I was so grateful, right? And I, in retreats, there will be people bawling. And I know when I walk by them, I send them metta. So I hold the story, I'm going to hang on to it, that actually the person did send me metta. So this, you know, to me is the quality of the Brahmavihara that can support us. And we actually have a choice to use it in a skillful way. Because in doing it, we absorb it more. Oh, which reminds me of my analogy of the four Brahmaviharas. Oftentimes, the Brahmaviharas, and I'll just say metta instead of the Brahmaviharas at this point, is consider qualities that we cultivate. And I think, which is essentially what I'm asking you guys to do. There is a quality to access, to choose. And it's often expressed that way in this way that I'm doing it, like because we have a hard time, we're hard on ourselves, we over-effort. And I like to think that there are qualities you already have, and that when we're practicing them, we're actually strengthening them. So the four Brahmaviharas are like a gym you go to, and there's a metta station, you know, where you, you know, do whatever this is, right? You build your biceps with metta, and then karuna maybe is your triceps, and then the leg lifts or upekkha maybe, you know, whatever is your favorite station. So we're just strengthening that muscle so that when we need it, we can use it for ourselves or to give it to others, to hold them in their suffering or to hold ourselves in our suffering. Yeah, Brittany and I, you know, have said more than once in the last 24 hours that we were really touched by the opening circle. How many of you really are coming here to find peace and ease and stillness? And so I think rest and restoration is really important for us as LGBTQIA2S+. For oppressed people, I think that rest and restoration, ease, metta, is so needed. So here's more from Charlotte Jokelbeck. To let the senses, same chapter. To let the senses, physical reality, and the bigger picture emerge, unfiltered by a core belief, is scary. The effort is our willingness to turn toward the unknown of this moment and stay there. We stay there without doing or thinking anything. That's where the effortlessness emerged. Our practice is to be aware of what's going on as soon as we can. Usually for the first second or longer, we get caught believing our thoughts. It takes effort to not hold on tightly to our caughtness. But with practice, the caughtness doesn't stay as long. We know we're caught, and in the noticing, the constriction loosens. We think we have to change something to do something. That sounds like a lot of work. I think that's why I got so tired. I was so focused on making it right. But primarily, when we talk about effort and practice, the effort is just turning our awareness to our own experience and then staying there again and again. We talk about effort, and we talk about effortlessness, the Zen thing. But really, we're talking about making a choice. What do we have a choice about, and what don't we? That's the question with suffering. What do we have a choice about, and what don't we? When we feel hurt by someone, we have a choice to rest attentively with that hurt instead of turning away towards comfort, justification, or even despair. We deliberately use our attention to raise questions. What am I doing? What's going on here? We ask these questions as a challenge so that the awareness can float something up. And then we say the question is more important than the answer. And this is a case of that. The question is not an invalidation of our experience. It's an opening, a curiosity, a sense of possibility that what else is here except my suffering, right? What else is here besides my suffering? To ask the question and leave behind our old familiar way of thinking takes effort. Other words for this effort could be diligence or attention. But what we find once we turn away from the comfort with practice is effortlessness. Effortless doesn't mean nice and comfortable. It just means we are aware that we are allowing what is to simply be. There's no choice here. No straining. Effortless. So when we choose to just be present in our field of awareness, and you're so fortunate, I mean, we're fortunate to be here in all the conditions of your life and the world, really, these days, for us all to be here, to just each day be able to just focus on that frame of reference that you're going to get every morning. And then also, the quality of how you do that will support connecting with the effortlessness that's always present. And yet sometimes it's hard to know. So that's why intentionally practicing the qualities of the four Brahma Viharas, right, will help us to thrive and not just survive. Choose metta when you're overwhelmed. Choose metta on the in-breath. Choose metta on the out-breath. When you lift your fork. When you open a door. When you cry. When you laugh. When you feel the sun on your face. Choose it and see what happens. Let's just sit for a moment. Goodwill on the inhale, peace and ease on the exhale, safety and protection on the next inhale. Connect to happiness, connect to well-being. Choose metta.